गुरवे गौड़चन्द्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। प्रणाम टू इच वन ऑफ यू, प्रणाम टू श्री गुरु गौरांगा साधुस पर्सनालिटीज ईच एंड एवरी डायरेक्शन from which we can derive the highest possible welfare if we just have the eyes to see. So here we are gathering to develop our eye, to develop our capacity to capture the absolute more and more in our hearts. So thanks so much for being today's satsang and greetings from New Delhi. I've arrived here 2 days ago, landing in Mother India, and a few days here, visiting some friends, going to the dentist and other technical issues. Tomorrow, having a small gathering with some local devotees, and then going to Vrindavan on Monday, where I'll be staying for a few weeks before traveling to West Bengal, and eventually meeting some of you there for our Navadvipa Parikrama in November. So here the climate is very lots of festivity. They are warming up from Deepavali, the festival of lights, which is kind of the Hindu Christmas, and they start celebrating like 2 weeks before and continue 2 weeks after. So that's an warming up and overflowing, and part of the warming up is music, high volume, firecrackers, and all as much lights and noises as you can possibly invoke. That's part of the standard, so we are welcoming all that. Atithi Devo Bhavan. Treat an uninvited guest as if it's God himself. I am an uninvited guest here, so we are perceiving each other. So beautiful to be with all of you today. So as usual, you're invited, and that's why I have the headphones just in case. I usually do not wear them, but if not, it will be difficult for me to hear you. So, as usual, we invite any questions, any sharing, any presentation, whatever feels relevant to you at this time of your journey, inner journey, life journey, whatever feels necessary to be made of an offering in Sangha. It's more than welcome, and it's a way of honoring each other's necessities on the journey and normalizing the journey, basically, with all its nuance and landscape and ups and downs and backs and forth and lefts and rights, and learning and recognizing depth everywhere, hopefully, no matter how ordinary it may seem, the path or the chapter of the journey we may be traversing. And so more than welcome to do so. In our new time, Indian time, more favorable for some of you, not so favorable for our Kiwi brothers and sisters from New Zealand, despite that Bhadra is still connected to something EM in the morning over there. So special, special mercy coming on her door. And Tato Darshini from Germany is raising her hand. So we'll start with her, and I'm not seeing any other raised hands. So if, in case you have something else to share after, invited to do so, but we'll start with Tato Darshini. Please, you can unmute yourself. Welcome.
Hi Krishna, welcome to Padmanabha. Nice to see you again.
My pleasure.
Actually, I have a lot of questions, but today was this one. Reading actually Devolution in Divine Love, and there is a passage, and I was churning it also in our Sangha, what we which we have, and it was not didn't become fully clear. In the first chapter, there is the sub-chapter Eternal Love, the Unceasing Goal. And there you write in Devotional Vedanta, Sri Chaitanya's profound revelation that love, not God, is the center of reality, reshapes the spiritual landscape. And I was wondering, I mean, so far for me, Krishna, God is the center of reality, and but here you say love, not God. But when love is the center of reality, this feels for me, or it felt for me, like a little bit an impersonal approach. On the other hand, I could say, okay, God is love, so it's the same, but you say love, not God. And so I came to a point I don't understand. I would be happy if you could a little bit explore what you mean with this.
Yeah. Thank you. Good question. You're an attentive reader. I appreciate the detail and how that can be confusing. But of course, there is a point trying to be made there, because of course, before speaking about this section, eternal love, the unceasing goal, I already talked about how love and God are the same, and God is love, Rasta by the hand, so on and so forth. So if God is love, love is God, in one sense, we should make a difference. Why we make a difference? But there is place to make a difference in order to emphasize something, right? Like in our tradition, Achintya be it a bit. So we could say, okay, God and love are a bit, they are the same. But also we can speak in forms of difference and an interaction between God and love personified, Sri Radha and so on and so forth. So in this particular case, when I say God, not love, is the center of reality, I try to make the point, though again, I may have failed in making it clear enough, though that's what comes in the next sentence when I say this paradigm shift carries these deep implications. Love reigns supreme, not only for us, but for the sweet absolute as well. So that's another way of saying what I say in the first sentence. In other words, the goal of life is love, not God. No, we will say that in our tradition, right? The goal of life is Krishna Prem. Love for God. I mean, includes God, but includes everything else. And it starts with the word love. The goal of life is Prem, love. Now, the goal of life is not Krishna. The goal of life is Krishna Prem. And then, of course, when you have love for God, you have God. But the point is, if I will say the goal of this, maybe this is an easier way to reply. If I will say the goal of life is God, so then what's the goal of life for God? Right? If you will say the goal of life for God is God, maybe it sounds a little narcissistic. So but if we say the goal of life is love for us and even for God, then that's another way of presenting love as the goal of life for everyone, including God. That's the main point I've tried to make in this section. I'm not trying to make an absolute separation between God and love, because again, one word for love in Sanskrit is Swarup Shakti. And Swarup Shakti means internal potency of one's own essence, Swarup, one's own internal form. So the internal being of Krishna, as much as we can talk about the internal, external, again, how much we can say God has an internal and an external parts. That's what also is mentioned in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad, of the 10th canto, Damodar Lila. All right, when Krishna is small child, we are celebrating Damodar Lila during Kartik. But at one point, you show that before the Damodar Lila per se, she's inspecting Krishna's mouth, as we know, and the whole creation is inside him. So how much he's inside something, how much something is inside of him. And there's one verse that says he has no inside, he has no outside. No, he has no back and front, left and right. In one sense, he's everywhere. But at the same time, sometimes we hear Swarup Shakti, the essence of God is love. So we cannot separate the two. But at the same time, there is a place to speak of the two slightly in separation. Again, one and different. That's the constant in our philosophical system, Achintya Bheda Veda Tattva. So I'm talking here, Sri Chaitanya's devotional Vedanta, which is our tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, whose goal is Prem, right? So that's the context in which I'm mentioning this. Now I'm rephrasing that in our language. Because in many traditions, even before Sri Chaitanya, generally, the main goals of life, purusharthas, are dharma, artha, kama, moksha, and the society of the time in India, and maybe outside of India as well. Many people who were practicing spirituality or affiliated with a religion did that mostly from a point of view of being morally correct, becoming good people, receiving things from God, having a good life on earth materially. Let's be honest. No, it's not. That's not only in the Vedas as karmakanda, right? Like you're somehow doing business with the divine, but every tradition has that karmakandic phase aspect. So dharma, artha, kama. No? Dharma means I behave well. Dharma, artha, so I can earn well. Artha, so I can kama, so I can enjoy well. I become a good boy, so I gain a good, have a good income, so I can have my dose of sense enjoyment. And we are not condemning any of that. Those are legitimate pursuits in the human experience. But then comes moksha, right? Which entails liberation. It speaks of transcendence, speaks of something more. So those four were the classical goals of life. And moksha even was not much of interest for the majority. What to speak of someone bringing a fifth goal on top of those four? Most people was interested again in bargaining with God, doing business, transactional stuff, being saved, not going to hell, more oriented by fear and calculation. On top of all that is moksha. But Mahaprabhu brought a fifth goal, Panchama Purushartha, a fifth goal of life, which is prem. So that's a very unique term in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. The goal of life is not dharma, not artha, nor kama, not moksha even, which was shocking at the time, but prem, divine love. And in order to establish the universality of prem, of divine love as a goal, and it's an unceasing goal, as I speak in this chapter, the notion is it's a goal not only for us, but it's even the goal for God himself. And nobody exposed that more in our, we will say, than Sri Chaitanya Dev, who is Krishna relishing what it means to love Krishna, right? That's the main focus of Gaur Lila, these most introspective moments of Krishna trying to explore his own heart through the lenses of Radha's love. What it means to have love for Krishna, Krishna is wondering. Oof, that was a you heard that one? Okay, that was a heavy one. So Mahaprabhu is Krishna experiencing Krishna Prem, basically, right? How Radha loves Krishna. So in that sense, that was the main thing here. So when I say love, not God, is the center of reality, means, of course, God is love in one sense, but at the same time, God becomes transformed by love, by his own essence, let's put it that way. No, by his own internal energy, he becomes transformed. He continually pursues that. So it could be another way of trying to separate between God and love, just to make it clear that if we have any ideas of God that do not include love, that's an idea of God worth discarding, so to say. So the center of reality is love. And God, we will say, though in essence is love, at the same time, he's pursuing love. He's pursuing his own essence. Again, these are words. This is language. How much we can put all this into words? It's complicated, I know. But if we say God is love, but at the same time, love is an unceasing goal even for God, then we have to say something like, God being love is constantly running after new levels, new depths of experience of his very essence, which is love. So again, there are different words to talk about it. This was one, and I'm sorry if it caused some confusion for the reader, but that was the main point I wanted to make. Because many traditions, again, some may say, God, the goal of life is God, But they are not so interested in loving God. Again, many times God is just someone there to provide what I need, to respond to my prayers where I call, to whatever. It's a servant of mine. God is over somewhere over there. And there's more interest in what we can receive from God than in what we can give, how we can love God. So that's why sometimes we need to emphasize the goal of life is not God, it's love for God. Again, love and God are ultimately not different, but most people do not have that very clear. So maybe for the sake of clarifying that, we may need to create an initial separation. So then eventually we make full circle and understand, oh, okay, now it makes sense. And again, the goal of life is love for us. The goal of life is love for everyone. Prem Prayojan, the ultimate necessity of life. And as I try to make the point clear in my book, it's an unceasing goal. So you can always reach a deeper experience of love. We, and Bhagavan included. No? And again, Sri Chaitanya Devi is like the personification of that project, of the divine, the sweet absolute, trying to discover newer and newer depths of the experience of divine love and finding no end, no bottom to that ocean. That's why we will argue Gaur Lila, this particular unique window of exploration, is eternal. Because in that particular place, in that particular laboratory, Bhagavan is exploring the depths of love. And since love has no end to its depths, it has no there's no end to the exploration of it, to the experience of it. It's not only endless, but it's ever increasing, ever expanding. It's not something that is endless, but it's not expanding, but it's endless, and you can never fathom. It's ever evolving, ever expanding. So I don't know. I don't know if that helps. If that makes some sense. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, my pleasure. Kanupriya is raising her hand. I like to ask Kanupriya if your question is quite related to this one. So maybe we can go straight to that. And if not, we'll invite each of you to share a little bit in the breakout rooms.
Actually, it is. It is also about love, so I think it's quite connected.
But very connected because we can talk about so many things in connection to love.
Shall I ask it and you decide if it's very connected or only?
Okay. Yeah.
So I listened to a lecture of you and you mentioned as it was just this short section and you said everything exists in the context of love. You know, everything exists in the context of love. And you mentioned also, yeah, of course, we also see things which are not good and suffering and so on, but everything exists in the context of love. And somehow this stroke me, is this the right word? So
Struck.
much struck. Okay.
Yeah, stroke means you had a stroke, you had a heart attack. So, which is possible, it's
Yes.
possible.
Almost. Also, somehow I had to stop and write it down, and then I was thinking a lot about this the next days. And so on the last meeting last Saturday, when you answered the question of Shvetadvip, Radhika, you said something similar. You shortly talked about suffering, and you said, why should there be no suffering? Because suffering also, we should not see it negatively. It
I
can
didn't
bring.
say there should be no suffering. I don't think so.
Why should there be no suffering? Because I think the question was, why is there suffering? But anyway, the point is that you said, okay, this is not, suffering must not be something negative, but it also can open the heart and so on. And actually, I don't have really a question about these two sentences, but I would like to hear more about this, and maybe you can connect these two sentences and elaborate a little bit more about this.
Okay, but first I'd like to ask the rest, what do you think? Is connected enough, or shall we go to the breakout room first and then address the question? It's not connected enough, Svetadup says. So as a chastisement, we are sending you all to the breakout rooms now. And after that, we will address Kanlupriya's question. And we have all to remember her question when we return. But first, we'll explore a little bit what the thoughts we shared regarding Tatvadarshini's question in terms of God not love being the goal of love, not God being the goal of life, and how that sounded, and all the topics we explore. And then, yeah, in a few minutes, 10 minutes or so, we are back talking about suffering, love, the necessity of it, or more explorations about that. Back. Welcome back. Hoping you had some deep, open, honest conversations with each other, fostering the awareness that we are already connected and related to one another as family, as universal family. So hopefully, even though if it's 6, 7 minutes, that could give us a glimpse and a taste of the universality of our interconnectedness. So we have another question that was already presented by Kanupriya. So she's not raising her digital hand. And we won't torture her, making her repeat her question again. So I like to trust that you still remember the question. And hopefully you didn't mix up the topics in the breakout rooms with one question and the other. It's all love, it's all connected to love, but still some differences, some nuance there. So Kanupriya's, well, it's not a question, as she herself said. This was more to something we talked about last weekend in my thoughts shared to Sweta Radhika's question last week. So suffering, as suffering being not something necessarily bad. Probably if I understood correctly, that was mostly the invitation to share some thoughts about the role of suffering, if we want to put it that way. And in the next book I'm writing, or I've already written, but it's not yet published, which is on unconditional love, as you already know, there is a big part on suffering, because again, I didn't want my writing to sound like naive or to sound like too romanticized. Oh, love and love and love. What about suffering? What about pain? What about evil? What about abuse? What about trauma? What about all that stuff? Now, in the context of love, if we say love is foundational, love is not only the goal of existence, but the source of existence, and it's existing in between the spaces of the words, in between the letters, in between the lines. It's all ever present, basically. Technically speaking, we could say we are all, if God is omnipresent, if God is love, love is omnipresent, we are all interpenetrated by love, no? Constantly. So, what about all the other stuff, which seems to be the opposite, which seems to be separate, which seems to be contrary, opposed to, whatever? Suffering, for example. But again, suffering is a response to something, right? To something that we care, something worthy, something valuable that somehow has been lost, or some has been damaged, or has been missed, or we have lost sight of it, or I mean, different types of suffering, of course. But at the end of the day, or in the words of Henry Nouwen, and probably I quoted that last week in my reply to Svetadip, suffering is your experience of not receiving what you need the most. Which again, that doesn't mean that what you need the most is not being provided. It just means that you are not receiving it. Which is, it's not just a play of words. Try to follow my point. Now, sometimes we assume that because we have not received something, that's not being provided, and therefore the provider is at fault, right? The providing agency is lacking. But probably we have not spent enough time questioning our own vessel capacity, our own receiving capacity, especially if what we need the most is unconditional love, which it is, I will argue, then there has to be a very specific vessel to hold such substance. And it may take time to not only build the vessel, but like to it's an ever-evolving vessel because the substance is ever-evolving. So to tend to the vessel constantly and reinforce it and nourish it and fill in the blanks. So how that's sadhana bhakti in one sense is preparing the vessel of the heart for the powerful descent of the milk of divine love. Now, sometimes in our tradition, there's this example of the milk from the lioness, which you need like golden vessel not to break, because if not, that somehow it say that that milk comes with a lot of power, and if you have any other vessel, the vessel breaks. Therefore, it cannot receive the milk. It cannot honor the substance. So you need a golden one, something that is, and as you know, gold. For gold to be gold, it needs to be put in the fire. It needs to be strengthened, not only by fire, but by being hit in different places, not being carved in its own way, being purified, if you want to use that word, so it becomes pure gold. And with all its qualities and with all its powerful receiving qualities to hold the space, not to receive the power substance. So I think that's an important point, and I'm not. It seems that I'm losing track of the question, but it's all connected. Trust me. So can renounce say it? Suffering means the experience of not receiving what we need the most. I will argue what we need the most is unconditional love. And I'm arguing that that's already being provided, but we may be failing in the experience of receiving it. And that may be because the vessel is not in place fully. Again, we may not have a golden vessel fully prepared to contain such a powerful descent. So sadhana bhakti, bhakti in practice, right? It's not bhava bhakti, bhakti in ecstasy, prema bhakti, bhakti in divine love. It's bhakti in practice. One way of defining sadhana bhakti is we are in the alchemy, alchemical process of crafting the vessel. Putting the ingredients together so we can not only understand and appreciate the nature of that love, nature of that gift, but have the integrity and the capacity of holding that, hosting that, knowing what to do when that comes. Now, what to speak of returning the love to God, returning the love to everyone. First, you need to survive the reception of it, right? Because this is no small talk, no small substance, no becoming hosts, no becoming vessels of divine love, becoming vessels of unconditional grace. That's no joke. No, if we just have a small vessel, a little broken, made of plastic, don't expect to the great thing, the great experience, because the whole thing is coming, but it's so overwhelmingly powerful and abundant that we may miss most of that, and we just get a few drops, which may be enough at one point and for the beginning. More of that will be drowned and it will be too much. But in time, the very nature of love, as I try to explain in my book, is ever-evolving, and it creates an ever-evolving thirst for it. So that invites for a further crafting of the vessel, further strengthening of the heart, a further preparation to host and hold deeper, broader expressions of that love. And that has no end. Okay. It's not there's a point that I have my PhD in crafts, embezzling, and there's nothing else to do in terms of that. Because again, love keeps evolving. So you keep evolving as an eternal vessel of that love. So again, suffering is the experience of not receiving what we need the most. Of course, that can take many forms, but at the end of the days, we all need the most unconditional love. Sometimes we are not experiencing that from our primary caretakers at home, and therefore it's difficult to for us that maybe to conceive that's even possible somewhere else. What to speak of God? We may not even have the capacity of thinking about God. But again, in some cases that may be coming, but we need to train the vessel, so to say. So that's a point I want to make in connection to suffering. Because again, many times we stigmatize suffering, so to say. Right? We may feel stigmatized by suffering. We may become play the victims in relation to situations that create suffering in our lives or seem to do so. But in doing that, we are stigmatizing suffering itself, like putting suffering in a box that says suffering is bad. This is undesirable, unbecoming, this shouldn't be happening, this is horrible, get out of my life, suffering. Instead of not only normalizing suffering, but embracing it from a redemptive place, embracing it from a place of openness. Like sometimes different teachers will say that suffering comes and cracks your heart open, speaking of vessels, and somehow that cracking open enlarges your heart space. So now your heart is bigger with a big opening, of course, and still bleeding, so to say. But then in that bigger space, then when love comes, you have more space to hold love. So in one sense, that's why I was talking a lot about this vessel and crafting a vessel. Suffering is a big part of the crafting of the vessel. Again, like gold becomes valuable, it put in fire, more valuable in the purification process with fire. With this corresponding hammering stuff, to give an analogy. So sometimes these situations in life, inner, outer, are like that. Our fire are like a hammer. We are being crafted. The vessel is being crafted. The vessel is being crafted. Now, that's a good one-liner, not to justify abuse that could be avoided, of course, but to go whenever, no, whenever I'm going through some situation when I feel literally I'm being put into fire. Right, fire of ordeal. Sometimes we have that expression. I'm being hammered. You are being crafted. The vessel is being crafted. The vessel is being crafted. How much do I want to allow the vessel to be further crafted? Because sometimes we say, no, I'm already crafted. There is already a vessel. There's no need for further vesseling, right? But then we are not getting the point. Because on one side I say, God, give me love. But no more furthering of the vessel. But love, if you ask for love and we need that and we ask for that, that's ever evolving, ever growing. So that, as we say also in our recently re in our retreat in UK, love always outgrows its vessels. That's the nature of love. It's outgrowing its former vessels. No? It's overflowing, it's brimming, spilling over, and it requires a larger container and a larger container and a larger container. And sometimes suffering plays that role in eternity. Let's take for a moment the example of what's going on in the realm of the Siddhas, the realm of the perfected ones. There is suffering. There is as much suffering as there is happiness there. And the two of them are not entirely separated, different. The two are contributing to the crafting of the vessel. Union and separation. Generally, union is connected with happiness, with the joy of union. No? Sambhog, no? Sanskrit word for union. Sambhog means, bhog means enjoyment. Sam means complete. So it gives this idea of complete enjoyment, complete happiness, celebration. I'm meeting my beloved. Joy, smiles, kijai. But then comes separation. And that brings the heart to another place. I'm not saying one is better than the other. Again, let's not be dualistic in here. Which is better, which is worse. The two are entirely necessary. Bhaktivinoda Thakur Rupa Goswami makes the point. If there is no separation, there is no union. Now, you cannot speak about Radha and Krishna being reunited if they were not separated to begin with. Right? So separation is facilitating the experience of reunion. You need one to have the other. So the two are two expressions of the same thing. And that's why one word for separation is biraha. And biraha means biraha, a special type of union. So that's why we speak about union, and then we speak about union in separation. Now, separation is not entirely divorced from union. It's just another form of union, which makes the heart grow fonder, which makes the vessel grow deeper and broader, which is a furthering crafting of the container. So this is happening in the realm of the perfected ones, and it's happening over here, so to say, as well. Even if we are not fully enlightened and we may go through suffering for some other reasons, we may be acting not in the most enlightened ways that has some consequences. We make other people suffering unnecessarily. we suffer as a result of that, so many forms that we may be suffering. But at the end of the day, we can all take advantage from that experience. And it can all be a further best crafting of the vessel. It can all be something that humbles us. Suffering generally can humbles us. It's not that we need suffering. It's not that God is arranging suffering so we learn something. It's not like, okay, you need to suffer so you get my lesson. No. Suffering happens. Life happens. No, things happen. And if we are rightly situated, whatever happens, be it suffering, non-suffering, whatever in between, we can all use that as a further crafting of the vessel. And I won't ask here for public confessions. Maybe you can do that in the breakout rooms. But I think if we look back to our own particular chapters in life regarding suffering, we have had very sobering moments there, humbling moments. Maybe not in the eye of the storm. Sometimes we were bewildered, confused, we didn't know what to do. But if we stayed enough with that pain, that has so many lessons to reveal. You have to sit with suffering enough till it reveals all the lessons it had to reveal. The problem many times is that we are fast to run away from suffering. Many times we have developed a whole culture of avoiding suffering, of creating as much pleasure as possible, things as easy as possible, as comfortable as possible, as immediate as possible, as creating the less difficulty possible. What to speak about grieving, no? The culture of grieving, ancestral culture of grieving. Many of those things have been erased from the collective unconscious of the present society. So when suffering comes, we don't have a clue what to do with that. So we want to run away. We don't want that to disappear, and we would just want to be happy. But if you are only happy, you are a very shallow person. Because to be a very deep, rich person means you have embraced all the spectrum of experiences and emotions. Happiness is not the only one. That's interesting because, for example, when you analyze in our tradition the main rasas, you have the five main rasas, seven secondary rasas. None of them says happiness. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad to be happy, right? But just to make a point that the whole thing is not just be happy. Now, five main rasas, of course, Santa Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and then you have what? Astonishment, anger, fear, disgust, chivalry, compassion. Many of them include suffering. No? Compassion is a form of suffering. Happiness is not appearing on the spectrum. Again, not to say there's no happiness, but probably to say do not become addicted to that. Or do not get the wrong idea of what's happiness. If we want, we can say, okay, happiness is the proper integration of all the other ones. Right? Happiness includes suffering. Happiness includes all these paradoxical elements that seem contradictory, opposite, and counterintuitive. Perfect happiness includes everything. Perfect contentment can embrace, can be nourished, can find sweetness in suffering. We have to reach to that level of expertise where you find sweetness in suffering. Not because you're a masochist, right? Because a masochist is not a sweet experience being a masochist. But find sweetness in the form of even in the worst possible situation, there is a jewel coming in one way or another. That by that I mean sweetness, wisdom, growth, expansion. Again, Viktor Frankl will say the goal of life is not happiness, the goal of life is purpose and meaning. Whether you're happy or not, that's secondary. Sometimes you won't be happy. Because if you set the standard as happiness is the goal, then every time you are not happy, you probably develop shame and guilt. Because, oh, I know the goal of life should be to be happy and I'm not happy, so I must be failing at something. And probably you are not failing at anything. It's just that something else is coming and you need to honor that, to find meaning and purpose in that. Right? So he will say, make that important point. In Sanskrit, one word for meaning and purpose is artha. And it's interesting because artha also means to the highest refers to the highest goal of wealth in life, prema, panchama purusharta. So artha can refer to divine love, but also prem, divine love, means the ultimate meaning and purpose. When you learn to love, everything has meaning and purpose. You can find a purpose in suffering. For some reason, this is going on. Not to be passive, not to be fatalistic, not to be complacent, but acceptance of whatever comes, and seeing that even if the greatest tragedy is knocking on your door, still there is a deeper meaning than the apparent tragedy. The tragedy may be there on some level, but love isn't always existing on a deeper level, holding it all together, binding, the glue that binds everything in between the lines. I'm not saying it's an easy exercise. We may need to really, that's why many times suffering invites us to go deeper, to learn from it. You need to become a very good student. Sometimes we don't want to be students of suffering. We want to just be masters of suffering so we stop suffering. But many times then we want just to be happy. And many times when everything is happy, 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 we do not learn to, we don't find much purpose sometimes. We become sometimes shallow and just like smiley and addicted to, like I will call harmony junkies, right? I want everything to be okay and nice and smiley and perfect and happy and jolly. That's not reality, nor here, nor in Golok Vrindavan. There's tragedy in Golok Vrindavan, as I say, on a daily basis, Radha and Krishna are dying from each other in separation. You have to take that seriously. You cannot just smile and happy, happy. You have to save their life of your friend. You have to be identified. You have to have tadatmya, oneness in identification with what my beloved is going through. And that has its own purpose. It has so much purpose and meaning that it has sweetness and depth and breadth. We may not call that happiness, but it's in a context of love. And of course, again, love always is happy, but happiness is not just one thing. No, again, that's why we will not say the goal of life is to be happy. The goal of life is loving. And love is there whether we are happy or not. It's unconditional. If not, we are putting it conditional, right? I want to be happy. So what if you are not happy? I want to be happy is a condition, right? All right, now if you say I want to be happy despite all, still, it's strange because sometimes someone is suffering. If you want to be compassionate, you will suffer with that person. And you may not call that I'm being happy at this moment, but that doesn't mean there's something wrong. Probably you are in a deeper place than when you are just happy by yourself, when you are in communion with someone else, sharing your hearts, blending your hearts together in love, in compassion. So the goal of life, again, is not happiness, it's love. Its meaning, its purpose, and everything is included there. No, that's why sometimes I say, even apparent emotions or expressions that for us at this stage seem totally like unbecoming, undesirable, like envy, right? Rupa Goswami describes all of these as symptoms of love in the ultimate realm: envy, anger, jealousy, fear, greed, all what we may call here anarthas. Are expressions of love. In other words, the idea is love can accommodate absolutely everything, suffering included. So again, we have to ask ourselves where we are now, how I'm dealing with suffering, what creates suffering. Because also that's the thing, right? We may suffer. The goal of life is not to stop suffering, but the goal of life is, to put it in one way, is to learn to suffer for the things that really deserve our suffering in a loving way. Because I can suffer in so many superficial ways. I can suffer because someone scratched my car and I got depressed and I cried the whole weekend. I can suffer because my soccer team lost the final and I'm suffering. Whatever, right? You name it. And you can really be suffering. Or I can be suffering for so many deeper reasons than that, and deeper reasons and deeper reasons. So the thing is not so much when I stop suffering and I'm happy, but when my current suffering becomes deeper. How can I learn to suffer for more dignifying reasons? Right? How can I suffer in a more dignified way? And dignified way. It all converges in the suffering of empathy when Radha Krishna or Mahaprabhu are dying separate. That's kind of the culmination of suffering, if you want, no? Longing in divine love. This all these motives. But it's a gradual ascension, so to say, to that point. So how? What's the type of the next version of suffering that I need to be upgraded to in my current condition? Not to condemn what we are suffering for now, to be grateful for that, but also to know if I'm trying to suffer in a dignifying way now, that will probably shed light onto the next version of it, a deeper one, a more encompassing one, a more universal one, a more loving one, a less selfish one, a less self-centered one, a less superficial one, a more significant one, a more purposeful one, meaningful one. It's a gradual process. Right? Some thoughts, Kanupriya, that's what you ask. So that's what I'm throwing to you. Now it's your turn to say something back.
Yes, this was not only
Are you
inspiring
suffering?
from.
Did I make you suffering with my words? Sorry for that.
No, but this day started with some hammering. And so for this was really hard soothing. Is it the right word? Thank you. Wow.
We are all in it. We are all, when we say swaha, we're all entering into that fire. Basically, swaha is I enter the fire. We throw a grain of rice to make it more gentle. But we should never forget the symbol there. That I'm the grain of rice and I'm entering a fire where I'm supposed to be refined. The vessel is supposed to be refined and crafted and make it stronger, and all my emotions and everything, suffering included, needs to be taken to another level of meaningfulness. And that's sadhusanga also, right? Joining hands, so we say the swaha all together and do the quantum leap. No, because if it's just me jumping by myself, it's like I don't want to go there. I will be burned, reduced to ashes. Yes, but nothing will come out of it. So no, something will come out of it. But so we need to join hands and say, okay, one, two, swaha. We jump all together, it's less scary, no? Less scary. And then we realize, oh, I'm still here and I'm refined. No? The fire has refined me, and I had some hammerings in between, but I've been carved a little more nicely than how I was before in my previous version. So it seems to be more, it was a little bit, have some scars now, but it's part of the crafting project. So you gain some more trust for the next swaha call. Right? You better have your friends, brothers and sisters nearby to join hands again and jump one more time, and so on and so forth. Right? That's what happens on a daily basis in eternity every time Krishna plays the flute. No, it's a swaha flute call. And at that point, the gopis do not ever think about it. They just run without the brain, without the mind, just like, phoom, no second thought, no first thought about it, no thinking. But to reach that level first, there's a preparation process again, sadhana bhakti. So, invited to share a little bit more your hearts, your experiences, whatever you may like to bring, so we can all together reinforce, prepare, refine the vessel in Sangha. So, for a few minutes, please share your reflections together in the breakout rooms, breakthrough rooms, hopefully, break open rooms if it's required, no problem. And then I see a few more raised hands, so we'll try to honor them as much as we can when we return in a few minutes. Welcome back, you all. Hoping you had brief but rich sharing. That's a sweet combination. So now we have three raised hands, but in the opposite order. So I want to do justice to the original sequence. And Karuneshwari went first. So we don't have that much time for the three, but I will try to make time for the three. Maybe I will replay a little shorter. We'll see. So please, Karuneshwari, yes.
Okay, it's a question for both of us. Ravinder's just gone for a second somewhere.
Okay.
It came up in the first chat in the breakout room after what you'd said in your first reply about this Dharma, Arta Kama, Moksha, and then this fifth point, which was added on by Lord Chaitanya, was Vishnu Prema. So then we were discussing, so in all of that time before this message of Krishna Prema, were all of the people not able to get Krishna Prema, and were they all just ending up in Vaikuntha?
Okay.
That's the gist of the question in a nutshell. But all through Satya Yuga, all the other yugas, when everything was apparently amazing.
Of course, thank you for the question, which of course invites to be more specific. Of course, I wouldn't say prema was not available. It's saying like divine love is not available is kind of one of the worst crimes against not humanity also, but against love itself. No, at one point there was no love, and at one point it started to be love, and it happened to be through our own religion. And before my religion started, nobody had that. No, but there is a specific type of love that Mahaprabhu experienced and extended that takes place at a certain time chronologically in this planet Earth. But also, again, don't forget that there are multiple universes according to our views, and multiple cycles of yugas taking place at different times. So it's not just, okay, if now we are in Kali Yuga and everyone is in Kali Yuga. No, everyone on this side of the constellation, so to say. So someone may be in Satya Yuga, another universe, in Treta Yuga, another universe, and whatever. And there are different forms of love. And of course, there are different expressions of love. Before Sri Chaitanya, there were books like Gita Govinda of Jayadev Goswami and many other works. The Bhagavatam itself, of course, speaks about love. But my main point, and thanks for pointing it out because maybe I didn't clarify it enough, and that's why maybe the question is there. It's not so much that Mahaprabhu brought something that never existed in any way. Yeah, I will add he brought something that never existed in that particular way, which is the extension of his own experience to this particular planet Earth in this particular time. Again, that's going on forever in eternity in Golok Vrindavan and Golok Navadvip in other universes. So I don't like to claim exclusivity, like only we had it in this age and nobody else before. Again, we are talking about eternal time space. And there are other traditions, even beyond Vaishnavism or other Vaishnav trends. There are speaking forms of love, although they may not use the word prem, because you gave the example, okay, they're all in Vaikuntha. But in Vaikuntha, there is prem. It's just Vaikuntha prem. No, it's not that prem is only one thing, right? They will not use the word prem, generally. They will use the word mukti, interestingly, like Sri Sampradaya. Other sampradayas that point to Vaikuntha, they will use the word mukti mostly, like liberation. But our tradition, like when you read Sanatana Goswami's Brihadbhagavatamrita and Gopakumari's visiting Vaikuntha, he will speak of them in terms of prem. So it's interesting, right? Because they themselves won't speak of themselves in terms of prem, but Sanatana Goswami, it's not taking advantage of that, so to say, and minimizing them, but he's putting the term we use the most, prem, and applying that to Vaikuntha as well. Just not to, because he could have the opportunity there to say, okay, these guys in Vaikuntha do not have prem. Only we, Gaudiyas, have prem. He said, no, they also have prem. It's another type. There are different flavors of divine love. And not only in Vaishnava traditions, in other wisdom, sister traditions, spiritual, mystical lineages, we won't say, oh, they don't have divine love. Only we have it. But again, Mahaprabhu somehow systematized, established the word prem, of course, what to speak of, embodied the word prem. He's called Prem Purushottam, right? It's God tasting prem to the highest degree. So somehow he embodied that. He's then encouraged the Goswamis to systematize that in his writings, the word, that as a fifth goal. Again, it may require some history and traveling time to notice the climate of the times and how everything was about Dharma, Artha, and Kamma, and everything spiritual was about moksha. So suddenly this word prem and this emphasis on prem as a goal was very unique to the lineage of Sri Chaitanya, but that doesn't mean there was no prem. Again, Bhagavatam is there depicting the prem of the so many devotees before Sri Chaitanya. The line of Sri Chaitanya was formed around the Bhagavatam. Previous books, again, like Gita Govinda, speaking in detail about the prem between Radha and Krishna. So it's not that it was not there, it was not spoken of, it was not experienced by anyone, but somehow Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so to say, shed special light on that word and on a very special, unique expression of that prem that he embodied. But again, not to the point of becoming, as I like to say, racists. No, racists in the context of Rasa. Only we have that prem. Only we. But there is a uniqueness to that, to what Mahaprabhu is given. As of course, we can say there is a uniqueness to many other great personalities and teachers or avatars of the divine to what they are given, right? In praising the uniqueness of Mahaprabhu's gift, we shouldn't do that to the point of saying there's no uniqueness apart from this uniqueness, right? As I wrote recently in this article on between Brahman and Bhagavan, yes, Bhagavan is especially unique in terms of affording the experience of the personalized loving relationship with the divine. That's unique in Bhagavan in comparison to Brahman, as impersonal Brahman. But there is a uniqueness in impersonal Brahman in its affording the experience of non-differentiatedness that generally you don't have with Bhagavan. So at the end of the day, those two are not two different guys. It's the same non-dual reality. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, so it was there, it just wasn't emphasized as much. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, as I say, again, speaking on this planet Earth, in this particular
Yeah.
time, Mahaprabhu is coming, he's relishing something and extending, no? The experience, the extended experience of his own experience. And in that sense, we will say there is something unique to that that was not there before. That's why this famous verse, Anarpita charim chirat karunaya avatirna kalu, that I recite sometimes in Mangala Charan, Samarpitum natoch balarasam so bhakti shriyam. That's one of the Mangala Charan verses of Chaitanya Charitamrita. And there to say, Anarpita, that which has not been offered before. Anarpita charim chirat karunaya avatirna kalu. By mercy, this avatar Sri Chaitanya Dev in Kali Yuga, he descends and bestows that. Again, that doesn't mean nobody else has experienced that in other eras, in other planetary system. Nobody's saying that's not going on in Golok Navadvip, but at this particular time, place, circumstance on this planet Earth in this universe, we could say, yeah. That's something not having not been experienced before. But that's part of the ever-evolving heart of the absolute also. No, it's not to say like it's I don't want to make a full comparison, but it's kind of the discussion between among Christians about, okay, what Jesus gave is unique. So before him there was no salvation, before him there was nothing, there was no Jesus. So it all starts from him, and before that everyone was damned or condemned. And then you have mystical Christians speak about the universal Christ and how Jesus is an embodiment of the universal principle of the Christ that is so very present, ever existing. So different but similar ways of thinking about, yeah, unique gift that the person of Jesus brought, let's put that example, but that doesn't mean that before him there was no access to grace or something. So in the same way, because it's Sri Chaitanya Dev, he came and gave something unique. There is a before and after that, but doesn't mean that there was nothing before and that there won't be anything after that, and that that didn't took place on top of that on another planetary systems, dimensions, times, and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, let's keep breakout room in this one so we have time to honor the remaining sharings. We have Rasangi. Rasangi
Thank you,
C
Marcus.
CA, which I imagine is California.
I'm the California Rasangi
To
now.
clarify,
Yeah.
okay, sometimes we may have some
Clarifying.
other Rasangis.
My
Okay,
other
no problem.
Rasangi counterpart.
Yes.
I just want to say thank you so much for what you just said. It's hard being the only one that has the truth. That's a huge responsibility. That feels like such a burden. If I'm the
Yeah.
only one that's carrying that,
And
It's
that's
like,
not, yeah, that's not possible. One idea that came to my mind, I want to interrupt, but I'm doing it, sorry. One quote that comes to my mind from Fridtjof Schoen, who is one of the main traditionalists. It's a particular line I did a Swami reacts on one book on traditionalism. And he will say one of his main teachings is different traditions contain valuable bona fide revelations. It's not just one. Because he made the point, if there will be, and I quote that, I think, in my series of articles between, in the first one, polymorphic monotheism. Let me check, because I want to quote it literally. Why not? To do justice to the author. Let's see.
I've heard you use that term
Yeah, so
before.
he says this. If God were on the side of one religious form only, the persuasive power of this form will be such that no man of good faith will be able to resist it. No? He has his language. In other words, he will say, if only one religion where tradition will be the only one, that will be so powerful and attractive that nobody could resist going in that direction. But we don't see that happening, right? It's not that everyone is irresistibly dragged toward Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever tradition. No, we have different expressions. So, anyhow,
But
my
Maharaj,
footnote.
that's nice. I love that. But what I also notice is when you can approach other traditions with a certain mood and share your experience, they become very attracted, and we become attracted to one another's connection and upliftment.
Yeah,
So
and
that's
maybe
what I see.
they become attracted to us, so to say, to put in one, to make a play of words. They will only become attracted to us if we become attracted to them first.
I know.
Right?
I
If
love that.
I'm repelling them, condemning them, rejecting them, downplaying them, they won't be attracted to engage in conversation. But if we have a capacity of being inspired by them, drawing insights by them, probably that will create that loop of reciprocation, reciprocity in nourishing. Yeah.
It's definitely a magical formula for sharing the good news, so to
Indeed.
speak. So,
Indeed.
Maharaj, my point is, it was in relation to Kanha Priya's point about, because I really love your class during the retreat on paradoxes. Everyone should listen to it, I think, and I'm going to listen to it again.
Did
What
you do
really,
the nine? Did you do the 9-dot exercise?
I did, I know I didn't. I watched though, I saw it.
Okay.
I got it outside the box, outside the box. Anyway, what really struck me, Maharaj, this has been a question I've had for a long time. How to go through those reversals? How to handle the paradoxes? Can I throw a tantrum? Can I go binge watch Netflix? Can I, you know what I mean? What's the best way to handle the reversals? And I love that you spoke about it. And we sit with it. We allow it to be. We open up to it, and we trust with faith that harmonization will come. I'll
Yeah.
learn and integrate what has to be integrated. And not only that, Maharaj, the last thing is that the benefit of that is that my relationship with the Sweet Absolute becomes deeper. And that those that don't allow the paradoxes or run away from them, avoid them, their relationships remain superficial and shallow. I mean, I think that's like a great advertisement for allowing, opening up to whatever, to what is, to right, and not, because I think it's not that we're not receiving those things. The way I'm receiving it is that I think I'm bad. I'm a bad person. I'm being punished. I'm being punished, right? When reversals
Not
come.
right, not right.
I know. But that's the way I have thought about it, that I'm being punished. I'm doing something wrong, like you say, but no, that shift of opening up, allow, seeing it as a gift, even though it's painful. I'm not saying it's fun or I want it, but allowing it to be there. opening up and accepting that it is, and then passing through, and then my relationship, like you said, with the sweet absolute is deeper. And there's probably more to be developed and talked about this, but I love that, and I got so much benefit from that. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. And yeah,
And if you have any.
one simple way to define faith is patience with mystery, as we many times say, right? And that has to do with the same. Mystery, paradox, it's just another word, but faith could be patience with paradox. And patience means waiting while trusting, right? Patience is not while waiting while distrusting and becoming more cynical and more conspiratorial or whatever, but waiting while trusting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And yeah, the paradox will reveal itself as something else. It will take us to a new way of thinking, a new way of accommodating. Again, speaking about the vessel we were talking before, developing more spaciousness, more capacity to accommodate reality, life, situation, hearts, complexity, developing, expanding our capacity to accommodate. That's one way of describing spiritual progress, right? We are growing in our capacity to accommodate things. That's the pattern, that's the pace of the divine. Krishna is constantly the GPS example, right? Recalculating. Recalculating not only means a new direction, but also a new spaciousness, more depth, more breadth to accommodate with in any in a minute ago will have been unaccommodatable. Now he's accommodating it. He's expanding. He's becoming more broad, more loving, more unconditional, more deep. Now the vessel has expanded, and we are invited to do the same, of course, to dance, to learn the same dancing steps. So yeah. Thank you.
And I would assume that the good reason for it is that we're growing into being able to accommodate more connection with the sweet absolute and
Yes.
that realm of intensity.
Yeah.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that intensity includes all the things we have been talking today also, right? Suffering, other stuff that still to us feels contradictory. Feels too paradoxical, and we still are a little bit monochromatic in our spirituality, just one color or a few colors, but we are not yet able to accommodate the whole rainbow, so to say. So it's a gradual process, and it's okay. No, it's okay, but we should not cheat deceive ourselves thinking there's an end point, there's something that I cannot accommodate and I will never accommodate. No, you ultimately love and kindness and the kindness of love that accommodates every kindness is a way of willingness to accommodate more. Now, the other day I was reading a line which was interesting and powerful, say something like love, no, kindness or love and kindness probably was, but we can use the same word, love, kindness is the only non-delusional response to everything. That was interesting, right? Kindness is the only non-delusional response to everything. If you don't reach that conclusion at one point, you are still under some form of delusion. Now, if you still feel to some things, kindness is not the response, something else. That's a form of delusion. In the ultimate perspective from God's eyes, love, kindness is the only non-delusional response to everything. Again, we may be far from that, but it's good to have a clear, so to say, goal in mind. So we can at least miss the mark, but miss the proper mark, right? Miss the target, but at least I'm shooting at the right target. Now, in one sense, the real deal is not so much hit the target, hit the aim, but it's get the right target. Because what's the purpose of hitting the center aim of the wrong target, right? So, anyhow, some thoughts. Teresa, you were raising your hands a few moments ago, but now you are typing, so you're doing something else. I don't want to interrupt.
It was something in the moment, and the moment's come and gone.
Okay.
So I don't know. Sam also had his hand up.
Sam, you raised your hand and then you unraised your hand. So, Phil, it's totally fine, but just asking.
I unraised it because I thought the question I have might be better to ask next week, because it's one of those questions. It's like it's going to need another Q&A.
Okay. Well, raise your hand first next week and we'll address that first if possible. Because, yeah, we are almost reaching our time. But also, I'd like to invite you one more time to share the breakthrough rooms to put our sharing to rest today and put myself to rest today. We're in Indian time here. So, yeah, spend some more minutes, hopefully, sharing with each other, reflecting together about this last theme that we were talking about paradox, patience with mystery, coexisting with that which we cannot control, kindness being the only non-delusional response to everything, and so on and so forth. So see you in a few minutes for our final goodbye of today. Welcome back. Welcome back, you all. And yeah, I hope you had a nourishing, open, intimate exchange like the two parrots behind Yamuna are having in this moment. Some secret whispering. Yeah, they are listening to me and they are replicating all that now, speaking to their ears in secret. So that's what Sadhu Sangha is about, whispering secrets with honesty, vulnerability, and being empowered by that. So thanks so much for being vessels of all that. And let's continue together doing the swaha into the fire, refining the vessel, empowering a container to honor the call of divine love on a daily basis. My greetings from Delhi. Next weekend, I'll be sending my greetings from Vrindavan Dham. Send your prayers so I can arrive well to the Dham and honor it properly. And also, very blessed celebration in a few days of Sri Govardhan Puja, which is one big, big moment for us, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, and many others as well. So, wish you a very blessed celebration over there. Yeah. Sadhu Sangha ki jai Gaur Premananda Hari Bol Vancha Kalpataru Vyasa Kripa Sindhu Bhyeva Cha Atitanam Pavanevhyo Vaishnavevhyo Namo Namah.